You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to the curator of the second largest collection of maps in the country, which is housed at UW-Milwaukee.
First, a new report from the Wisconsin Policy Forum shows that nearly three-quarters of the state's counties are facing a significant shortage of psychiatrists.
The shortage is particularly bad in northwestern Wisconsin, where a stretch of 10 counties has no psychiatrist at all.
Jason Stein is the director of research at the nonpartisan Wisconsin Policy Forum. Jason, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Jude.
So lay out the findings for us. How bad is this shortage?
Well, when you look at data from the Wisconsin Medical Society, you see that 20 of Wisconsin's 72 counties have no psychiatrists at all. 10 more have less than one full-time psychiatrist because they're sharing one with multiple counties. If you look under the standard the state uses, 55 of the 72 counties in Wisconsin have a psychiatrist shortage. The federal government has a little tighter standard, but even under that, 37 counties, or more than half of the state, have a shortage of psychiatrists. And because psychiatrists are older, are aging, particularly in these shortage areas, the problem is even a little worse than just the raw numbers show.
And before we dig into the data and what it means, what do psychiatrists do that not having a psychiatrist in a county or a larger area, what kind of hole that leaves?
Sure. Well, I mean, in broad terms, psychiatrists play an important role, you know, diagnosing and treating mental health disorders, including prescribing medications. And so they do perform some functions that are specific or, you know, at least reduced within the healthcare system to that role. And so, you know, it is pretty important to have a supply of practitioners.
So there may be psychologists, counselors, therapists, but there's no one in that area that's able to prescribe medication if it's needed.
They certainly play a key role in that area.
So tell us about some of the places where the shortage is really acute. Are there other commonalities of those areas besides the fact that they don't have psychiatrists?
Clearly, they tend to be rural areas in the northern part of the state, particularly northwest of the state, although you also see some of these counties in the central Sand region in the central part of the state. You also see as well, you know, these are areas where there is as well shortages in other types of healthcare disciplines, but it's, you know, appears to be particularly acute in the realm of psychiatry.
And as you mentioned, there psychiatrists are in short supply. Also, it's an aging group in the medical field. Is this something that's been building over time, or did something change that has really put extra stress on this situation?
Right. So that's a little outside the scope of our report, but we did look at national data that suggested that this problem could be getting worse. When you look at 2003 to 2013, the number of physicians in the U.S. increased by about 14%, but the numbers of psychiatrists stayed flat, declined slightly. So there is some evidence to suggest that this may be getting worse for, in particular, in the area of psychiatry.
We're talking with Jason Stein right now. He's the director of research at the nonpartisan Wisconsin Policy Forum. Their new report is looking at a crisis of a shortage of psychiatrists in many Wisconsin counties. And certainly mental health is a very large field, Jason. One big part of it is dealing with addiction. And, you know, we are dealing with an opioid crisis here in Wisconsin, across the nation, other types of addiction. Tell us how this shortage of psychiatrists can play out in the face of the opioid crisis.
Well, we do see significant treatment gaps in Wisconsin, as identified by the State Department of Health Services. And, you know, so part of that is the treatment gap specifically for addiction. So the department found that less than one quarter of the estimated 456,000 state residents in need of treatment for addiction receive it. So that's a gap of like 77%. So again, you know, when you're talking, now that's looking at, you know, overall treatment providers, but when you're looking at, you know, gaps like that, certainly not having an adequate number of psychiatrists is going to contribute to that.
And let's kind of put some faces and stories on this issue. So for people living in one of the 55 counties where there is a psychiatrist shortage, what does that look like, and how does that manifest in their day-to-day lives?
Well, I think the thing that was most striking to me is that if you look in like the northwest part of the state, so the counties that are north of Eau Claire, you see that, you know, in some cases, if you're in a county like Rusk, not only does your county not have any practicing psychiatrists, but none of the contiguous counties have a practicing psychiatrist. So you could be looking at driving not just one, but a county and a half or even two counties over to reach a practitioner who, you know, again, and there's not a guarantee that that practitioner would have the right expertise for the particular problem or have availability. So, I mean, that sort of speaks to if you were, say, parents that had a child that was challenged with autism or, you know, some other mental health challenge like that, you can see the potential difficulties that that family might face in accessing treatment.
And it seems like a lot of times when someone needs to see a professional, it's quickly because there's been some kind of a crisis or something has gotten to a breaking point. I'm guessing that there are long wait periods if a psychiatrist in County X is actually serving the 10 counties around it. So where do people end up if they can't get in to see the appropriate mental health professional?
Right. And so some of this questions like waiting lists are outside the scope of our report, which is relatively short and mainly aimed at just starting a conversation about this issue, or at least deepening it. But I think clearly, you know, one of the things that we speak to is, you know, there are potential solutions, and we can talk more about that. But, you know, one of them would be potentially telemedicine, in which you would do consultation through technology at a distance. But again, some of the challenges there could be that, you know, to the extent that there are overall gaps and an overall shortage of psychiatrists, you know, to a certain extent, even the availability of teleconsultations may not help if there isn't an adequate supply of psychiatrists overall. So, I mean, that is one of the challenges you're looking at here as you try and address the problem.
And looking at other possible solutions, what about efforts in recruitment, not when necessarily when students are coming out of medical school, but much before that?
Right. So, I mean, there have been initiatives that have been started. The Medical College of Wisconsin opened two psychiatry residency programs in northeastern and central Wisconsin in 2017. There are other programs such as a rural outreach curriculum that has been put in place, the Wisconsin Academy for Rural Medicine. So there are initiatives that are out there seeking to address the problem. But at the same time, you know, it certainly appears that it's going to be pretty persistent, at least in the near future.
And is there any effort to make psychiatry more attractive to medical students? Because one of the things that I read is that it's actually one of the lower paid specialties.
I mean, that clearly could be playing a role as well. I think, you know, potentially increasing psychiatry residency class sizes or rural psychiatry residency programs may also help, in particular because people that go into the discipline tend to practice in some cases where they studied. They may also end up practicing, you know, where they live. So another option would be to try to recruit you know, future psychiatrists from within the areas where the shortages are found.
Well, Jason, thanks so much for joining us and sharing the information in your report.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That was Jason Stein. He's research director for the Wisconsin Policy Forum. He was with us to talk about the group's new report showing a shortage of psychiatrists in 55 of Wisconsin's 72 counties.
Coming up, more than 1.3 million items make up the second largest collection of maps in the country, and it's located at UW-Milwaukee. We'll take a tour of that collection coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, a look at Wisconsin's important role in the world of jazz.
First, UW-Milwaukee is celebrating the 40th anniversary of the American Geographical Society Library coming to the school. The collection is made up of more than 1.3 million items, including maps, atlases, and books, making it the second largest geographical collection in the country.
Materials include a map showing what a European mapmaker thought the world looked like in 1452, right alongside charts signed and used by aviator Charles Lindbergh.
Marcy Bidney is the assistant director of libraries at the UW-Milwaukee. She's also the curator of the American Geographical Society Library. Marcy, welcome to the show.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Well, how did this collection come to be housed at UW-Milwaukee?
It's a long story, but I'm going to try to give you the short version. The short version being that the American Geographical Society, which is a professional organization that still exists today, built this really fantastic collection starting in 1852. And just about in the late 1960s, early 1970s, they understood that they weren't going to be able to provide a proper house for it anymore. And so they did a national search for a place to relocate the entire library. UWM put their name in the hat for the running to be the place for the library to come. And we won, I guess, yeah.
So well over a million items in this collection. Can you give us a sense of the range of what's in there?
We have approximately somewhere around 550,000 maps in the collection, somewhere in, on the verge of 625,000 images in our photo collection. And then the rest of the bulk of the collection is made up of atlases, globes. We've got about 220 globes, books, journals, and all covering a variety of topics related to geography, travel and exploration, history of cartography, history of science, history of photography, you name it, we've got it.
And this goes back hundreds and hundreds of years, spans the globe, and has lots of local material in it too, right?
Correct.
So talk about, let's start at the old end. We've got a 1452 map of the, well, I guess the known world at the time, known from Europe. Can you talk about the oldest part of the collection?
Yeah, it's so the oldest piece you're right is from 1452. It is a map of the world. And though we're on radio, I can describe that when you're looking at this map of the world, it doesn't really look like a map of the world as we are used to seeing maps of the world today. It was done by a cartographer named Giovanni Liardo, who was Venetian. And there are three of his maps left in the world, and we've got one of them. The other two live in libraries in Italy, in northern Italy. It's a beautiful map. It's more than 500 years old. It's in incredibly good condition. We have it framed in the collection, and anybody who wants to come into the library to take a look at it is welcome to do so.
Yeah, can you talk about, I want to talk about research in a minute, but for the public, I assume we can't go paw through the entire collection ourselves, but what kind of stuff could we see there?
You can't come in necessarily, like you said, paw through the collection, but we encourage the public to come in to use the collection. We are a public institution, so funded by the state of Wisconsin, so we are open to the public, and a lot of people come to use the collection for genealogy research. We host researchers from universities from around the world to come to the collection to do their research on whatever topic they are researching, and you can come in if you're looking for a map of a particular place. You can come and say, hey, I'd like to see a map of Warsaw, Poland, and we will pull out some maps of Warsaw, Poland, and you can take a look at them.
I understand. I hadn't heard of these. We did an interview with somebody who talked about researching old buildings as part of genealogy often, and there are these fire insurance company maps.
Yeah.
They kept really good maps, and you've got a lot of them. What kind of things do you have, and what do people do with those?
Yeah, so the Sanborn fire insurance maps are a really important piece of our collection, particularly for Milwaukee history. We have the Milwaukee Sanborn maps from the mid-1800s up through the early 90s. 1900s. And the Sanborn Fire Insurance Company is exactly what it sounds like. It was a fire insurance company. So if you are a fire insurance company, you provide fire insurance. And so what you need to know is a lot of information about the buildings in a particular place. You need to know what they're made out of, how tall they are, where there are windows, where there are doors, are there other sorts of exits like a balcony with some steps. You need to know what's happening in that particular building. Is it a residential building? Is it some sort of manufacturing? Is it a store? And so the Sanborn company mapped towns across the United States at this level of detail and over time. So they're really important for people doing genealogy because we can see who, in many cases, see who lived at a particular address. We can see where manufacturing was in early Milwaukee. We can see, they're fun to look at because we can see certain older parts of the city where things have been torn down and rebuilt over, and you can see that. One of our graduate students just created a web map, and you can find it on our website online, where the Sanborn maps, the old maps, are overlaid on what we call a web map, so sort of a Google map interface.
Oh, cool.
And you can search by address, and right now we only have the 1910 maps up, but you can search by address, and you can then use a slider to change the opacity of the maps, and you can see through the old map to the new web map and see what's there now and compare what used to be and what used to be in Milwaukee in 1910 and what is there now. And it's really a fantastic app. The other really important role it plays for Milwaukee history is it gives us the old street information. So in 1935, Milwaukee changed a lot of their street names, and it's always a challenge when you're doing historical research for the city, because you have to remember that that happened. And then you have to do some kind of translation like, this place used to be this on this street, and now it's this street. And so you have to kind of remember that. And having it online as a web map is a really great way for everybody in Milwaukee to be able to figure those things out more easily.
Talking to Marcy Bidney with the UW-Milwaukee Libraries, curator of the American Geographical Society Library, this huge collection of maps, atlases, images, and more. Marcy, a lot of this is online. I was just poking around, and it could get dangerous. I almost spent too much time poking around on the digital collection. Can you talk about what's up there?
We have a range of items available in our digital collection, and we're adding to it on a daily basis. We have, I think, around 10 to 12,000 maps uploaded into our digital collections, and we don't have a particular focus as far as the map collection is concerned. We try to do a range of places around the world. If there's some hot topic going on in the world and we have maps that are related to that particular topic, we'll try to get them up. And then the bulk of our digital collections really is our photographs, and mainly because our photograph collection isn't actually print photographs. It's really the film negatives. So in order to make them usable as images, we have to digitize them so that then we can have actual, like we can see what the image is without having to use a nitrate negative or a glass plate negative. So in the early 2000s, we had some grant funding from the National Endowment for the Humanities that allowed us to digitize around 100,000 of those images. We have about 80,000 of them online, and ranging in time frames from the late 1800s up through, I'd probably say, like about the 1970s right now. And we're also adding photos to the digital collections on a daily basis.
Now, Marcy, this is probably a really unfair question, but do you have a favorite map or series of maps in the collection?
It is an unfair question, but I get asked that question all the time. And we try not to have favorites, but it's really difficult. And it's actually really difficult to have favorites because there are so many maps in the collection, so to pick one is really difficult. But for the last couple of years, I do have one set of maps, actually, that is my favorite. And it's a set of what we call wind and current charts, and it's sounds totally unsexy as far as maps are concerned, but the maps show the wind and current directions on the oceans around the world. And they're my favorite because they were made in the 1850s, And it was the first time that that information was visualized. And they were created by a cartographer, naval guy, oceanographer named Matthew Fontaine Maury. And he gathered the data by reading through thousands of naval ship logs. So just read, recorded the information, and then mapped it. And he did all of that with his brain and some paper without a computer and made some really fantastic maps. And it really contributed to improving navigation around the world. And particularly, it cut the sailing time across the Atlantic in half.
Wow.
Yeah, because the sailors were, you know, they always had a general idea of where the wind and currents were, but when you can be exact and know where you're going to pick it up and what season the wind is going to blow in a particular direction, you can hop on that current real fast, and it's going to speed up your time across the ocean. So they're really just a fascinating set of maps. And I think for me, it's really the science behind them that keeps me going back and looking at them and just being amazed.
Well, and very briefly, that sense of historical connection with the person on the other end of the map, the person who made it.
Yeah, right. And he was a pretty incredible guy. He's also considered the father of oceanography, so really started the study of the oceans around the world. So really a fantastically interesting human being.
We'll leave it there. Marcy, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Marcy Bidney is the Assistant Director of Libraries at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She's also the curator of the American Geographical Society Library, the second largest collection of maps in the country. It's housed there at UW-Milwaukee.
Coming up, we'll learn about the past and present of Wisconsin's jazz music scene with the author of the book, Wisconsin Riffs, Jazz Profiles from the Heartland. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. It is Election Day. We'll start airing NPR's election coverage starting at 7 tonight. And when the polls close at 8, we will bring you local coverage of all the big statewide elections in Wisconsin. Tune into election coverage starting at 7. For the time being, you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up tomorrow after 8 on The Morning Show, John Munson and his guest look at whether the midterm elections turned out to be another year of the woman. That's tomorrow morning after 8 here on the Ideas Network.
Now, there are a few big jazz names you might know. Les Paul, Al Jarreau, Bunny Berrigan, who we're hearing behind us right now. But did you know that they all got their start right here in Wisconsin?
A book from the Wisconsin Historical Society Press highlights Wisconsin's place in jazz history with profiles of some of the state's great musicians and their role in the state, national, and world jazz scenes.
Kurt Dietrich is a professor of music at Ripon College and author of the book Wisconsin Riffs, Jazz Profiles from the Heartland. Kurt, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me on the show.
Now, you are a music performer, an instructor yourself, not originally from Wisconsin. Coming from the outside, what was it like to come here and play and teach jazz in Wisconsin?
Well, I grew up in Virginia, but I ended up going to school at Lawrence University up in Appleton. And I just happened to be there at the right time when Lawrence decided to start an official jazz program. And there were some great students there, and then they hired a wonderful instructor, John Harmon. And once some of us had been there for a while, John decided that essentially we should run away and join the circus. And we started a band and traveled for the second half of the 1970s all over the country.
And people around the world might not think of Wisconsin as a home to a lot of jazz. People in Wisconsin might not think that either. Why did you want to tell this story?
Well, I got into this book because of a failed project that I was working on, but it turned out to be a great thing for me. And so I wanted to write another jazz book. I had written a couple already, and I thought, if I write about Wisconsin people, I can write about whoever I want to. And if a certain person won't talk to me, I know somebody who knows that person, and they'll talk to me. And it just seemed like, okay, this is a project I can do. I had no idea exactly how it was going to turn out, and it turned out to be a much bigger project than I thought it was going to.
This seems like one of those stories where once you start looking, you keep seeing more and more and more, and then your biggest worry is, uh-oh, who am I leaving out?
Yes, and in fact, I have a printed list of about 50 people that I did leave out.
Wow.
But at a certain point, you know, I just had to say, this is it. If I don't stop, I'm never going to finish the book.
Well, you talk about musicians past and present, and I want to start in the past with a few names. Bunny Berrigan, born in Hilbert, Wisconsin, east central part of the state, one of the country's most legendary jazz musicians. Can you tell us a little bit about him?
Well, he moved. His family moved when he was very young to Fox Lake, which is close to where I live up here in Ripon, Wisconsin. And he, early on, like so many musicians, showed skills and talent and started playing. And by the time he was a young teenager, he was playing in area bands. And this was in the 1920s, and bands were traveling already then, and we think of the 30s as being the start of the big band era, but it was already going on before that. And also, while still a teenager, he was not doing well in school because he was doing too much playing, but he moved to Madison with a relative, and of course the scene in Madison was much bigger. While there in Madison, his network grew, of course, and he was playing on the UW campus at parties a lot. He was playing in the theaters downtown. And a friend of his got a job with a band out in New York City, and he called Bunny and said, can you come out here and play? He did. He came back to Wisconsin briefly, but shortly thereafter he moved to New York, and he basically lived in New York the rest of his life.
I want to give a listen to one of his biggest hits. He played with a lot of bands, ended up fronting his own band. This is a bit of I Can't Get Started. Trumpet sounds of Bunny Berrigan there, and you cited critics who put him, you know, mentioned him in the same sentence with Louis Armstrong. Louis Armstrong spoke very favorably of him. That's about as good as you get in that era, right?
That is about as good as you get, yes.
And he sadly passed away at an early age, had a long time problem with alcoholism. That's sadly a common story in the jazz and music world, period. Can you talk about that a little?
Well, with him, it's hard to say, and of course now we look at alcoholism in a little different way than people did back then, but it was evident from early on that he had a problem with alcoholism, and he played with some of the great bands and especially made some very famous solo recordings along with Benny Goodman's band and with Glenn Miller's band in the 30s and 40s. But he didn't stay with those bands in part because he had something else in mind probably, but chances are that he wasn't too reliable either. Because of that and because of his alcoholism, and when he finally got his own band, because that's what big stars did back in the 30s, is somebody would say, well, this guy is a fantastic trumpet player. He needs a band too, just like, let's say, Gene Krupa, the drummer, left Benny Goodman to start his own band. But Berrigan was a terrible businessman, and he had no real interest in that side of things. And he really didn't seem to be the kind of person who paid a whole lot of attention to details, itineraries, directions, those sorts of things. So, unfortunately, yes, while the record that you were just playing became a huge hit for him after he started his own band, his own band was not a success, largely because of his own personal characteristics, alcoholism on the one side, and again, his lack of interest in the business side of things as well.
Talking to Kurt Dietrich, his new book is Wisconsin Riffs, Jazz Profiles from the Heartland. Want to give a listen to another big name from Wisconsin, Woody Herman, one of his hits, and I actually played this in a jazz ensemble back in my high school years, Woodchopper's Ball. Woody Herman, another musician who made his name and ended up forming his own band. Can you talk a little about Woody Herman's Wisconsin roots?
Yeah, well, he grew up in Milwaukee, and by the time he was a teenager, he was performing at that time in shows that we would probably refer to as vaudeville. He was known as the Boy Wonder, and he played saxophone, he sang, he danced, he did the whole bit. In his late teens, he also joined a touring band, and eventually he ended up with a band of Isham Jones, who is known today more as a songwriter than ever a band leader, but Isham Jones didn't need the money anymore, so he decided, I'm done with this band. And so he said, I'm out of here. The other members of the band said, we have a really good band, we need to keep it together. Woody was only 23 years old, but he probably had more experience in show business than anybody else in the band at that time. So while everyone owned an equal share of the band, he was the de facto leader of the band. And as people left the band, which happened all the time during the swing era, Woody would buy up their share until eventually it was the Woody Herman Band. And the track that you just played was the first big hit that Woody Herman's band had in 1939. The thing about Woody, though, is that he never quit. He continued to lead a band right up until very close to his death in 1987. And while a lot of people think of the Woody Herman Band as that band from the 30s or maybe the 40s, his band continued to change. It continued to bring in great new players over every decade. And when I was in high school in the late 1960s, I heard a brand new recording by the Woody Herman Band, and I just thought this was unbelievable, and it had very little to do with the swing era. Later on, when I was a traveling musician in the 1970s, the band I was with was booked by the same agency that booked Woody's band, and so occasionally we would open for Woody's band or share bills with Woody's band. Still great players in the band. Woody was still carrying on, and as I said, he continued to right up until his death. 50 years he was a band leader.
We're talking to Kurt Dietrich, professor of music at Ripon College, author of Wisconsin Riffs, Jazz Profiles from the Heartland.
We'll pick up that conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our conversation about the history of jazz in Wisconsin with Kurt Dietrich, author of the book Wisconsin Riffs.
And we want to hear from you. What was the best jazz show you've seen here in Wisconsin? Who's your favorite local jazz musician? Does the jazz from your part of the state have a particular sound? Tweet us at CentralTimeWPR and let us know.
Before we go to our callers, I want to fast forward a little bit to, this is close to your heart, actually, Al Jarreau, Kurt, a big connection with Ripon College. Can you talk a little bit about his jazz career? He's really well known as a pop singer, very big jazz singer, too.
Yeah, well, that was my connection with Al Jarreau, was through Ripon College. I've been teaching here for 37 years now, but Al Jarreau was a student at Ripon College. He graduated in 1962. He had grown up in Milwaukee. And interestingly enough, he was introduced to Ripon College because the model government event every year that the American Legion puts on, Badger Boys State, is at Ripon College every summer. And Al Jarreau was a representative from his high school in Milwaukee, Lincoln High. And he came up here, and during the week that he was here in the summer, right after his, well, I guess it was between his junior and senior years in high school, He was elected governor of Badger Boys State. Well, he got a scholarship to come to Ripon College, and so he did. He was a psychology major. He did a lot of music while he was on campus. Among other things, too, they had a quartet that was the kind of quartet you would find in a lot of places at that time, the early 60s. I don't want to say it was a doo-wop quartet, but they did a lot of that kind of music. But Al also was chosen to sing at the Miss Wisconsin pageant around that time, which I think must have been amazing for an African-American at that time in Wisconsin. But yes, he had his career here. He then went on to graduate school at the University of Iowa in psychology. He moved to the West Coast, and he started singing in clubs in the San Francisco Bay Area. And it's sort of like the rest is history after that. He was discovered, he started making records, and became a huge star. You mentioned being a pop singer. Well, it's interesting to me that while I think of at least Al Jarreau's early music as definitely being jazz, I think jazz musicians tend to sometimes think of Al as a pop singer, but I think fans of pop music, a lot of them think, oh, Al Jarreau, he's a jazz guy, isn't he?
Well, here's Al Jarreau and Take Five, the Dave Brubeck classic, a little of a live performance here.
Just have to take a little time out with me. Oh, just take five, just take five. Just happy, please, baby, and take the time out to see that I'm alive, I'm alive. Although I'm going out on my way just so I can pass by each day, not a single word do we say.
Sounds like a jazz singer to me. Kurt, I want to go to our callers now. We have many of them. Let's go to Nancy with us on the line in Wausau. Nancy, hi.
Hi there.
What do you want to tell us about Nancy?
I was so excited when I tuned in and I heard you guys talking about Bunny Berrigan. When my mother had passed away, I had grabbed all these old jazz albums she had, and they were 78s. They came in like a book style. And Bunny Berrigan, she has several albums of his. And I had to dig out an old record player to listen to them. But I was just fascinated at his style of playing. And I'm a huge follower of jazz rock. I follow the band Chicago to this day. And their arrangements, their early arrangements. So I just wanted to say thanks for mentioning Bunny Berrigan.
Nancy, thanks. And Kurt, Wisconsin does remember Bunny Berrigan. There's still performances kind of in his honor in the state, right?
Right. As a matter of fact, this weekend is the weekend that for years and years they have had the Bunny Berrigan Jazz Jubilee in Little Fox Lake, which was his hometown. And so for the weekend coming up starting on Friday night, there will be lots of jazz music in Bunny's honor in Fox Lake. And one of the performers there every year, he doesn't trade on this at all in his professional life, but is Bunny Berrigan's nephew, Kay Berrigan, who is an outstanding jazz trumpet player and has been for decades down in Milwaukee.
Nancy, thanks a lot for sharing that story. We'll go next to Tim with us in Neenah. Tim, hi.
Hi, I'm calling. I plan on picking up the book, and I think the professor is being very humble in not mentioning his group Matrix, which at the time was reviewed on the West Coast by the great Leonard Feather as one of the best bands to come around way ahead of its time. So kudos to the professor, and thank you for sharing, and I plan on picking up the book.
Tim, thanks a lot for the call. Kurt, that was your own band, Matrix, one of two different bands named Matrix, you write. Talk a little bit about this. This was a kind of a jazz rock outfit.
Right, and as I mentioned earlier, when I was at school at Lawrence, there was this core of really fine musicians, and John Harmon came there to teach jazz. I went off to graduate school for a year, but then I got a call saying, we're starting a band, and you're going to be in it. And so we started the band, and we, in fact, played a lot of music of the woman on the previous call talked about Chicago and Blood, Sweat, and Tears, that all that music was happening then. But eventually we were doing all our own music, and we were discovered in a kind of dive bar down in the Chicago area by a big agent. And so we ended up touring for 5.5 years. We played at the Monterey Jazz Fest, at the Newport Festival in New York, at the Telluride Jazz Festival, and so forth. So, yeah, it was a pretty exciting time.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Kurt Dietrich, author of Wisconsin Riffs, Jazz Profiles from the Heartland. Back to our callers now. Mark is on the line, and Nina. Mark, hi.
Hi. Can't wait to get the new book, and I wanted to ask if Kurt had some favorite hole-in-the-wall dive jazz clubs or jazz bars around Wisconsin he likes to go to.
Hole-in-the-wall jazz clubs. Kurt, you got any suggestions?
Well, jazz isn't played in clubs all that much anymore, and when it is, fortunately, they're not usually holes in the wall. The jazz club for, how can I put it, not traditional, but sort of standard jazz, post-bop, in Milwaukee is the Jazz Estate, and the Jazz Estate has been running for years and is a club that has had kind of a resurgence just in the last few years. But I was fortunate enough to give a talk on my book down there a couple of weeks ago. They had live music, and they have live music, live jazz there practically every night. In Madison, it kind of changes. For some time, the Cardinal Bar was the place. The North Street Cafe now is having quite a bit of jazz going on, and that's definitely a good spot. And again, it keeps changing. There were a couple of places on State Street that were having jazz but have changed. It's really not easy to hear live jazz in Wisconsin, except in Madison and Milwaukee, and I'm sure there are places in Eau Claire also. I'm not nearly as familiar with the other side of the state, but I strongly recommend the Estate in Milwaukee.
Mark, thanks a lot for that call. Kurt, as we wrap up, would you like to see more venues around Wisconsin outside of Madison, Milwaukee start to pick up the mantle and host that jazz show, big or small?
Oh, absolutely. And I am leaving some things out. I mean, there are people up here. I'm just south of the Fox Valley, and there are places in Oshkosh. There's a restaurant called Beckett's that has jazz from time to time. On a fairly regular basis, and I know in Appleton that some guys are finding some work up there. Sometimes maybe it's just a duo in a bar, piano and bass, for example. But, yeah, just keep your eyes open. And, of course, the big thing is people need to go out and support the musicians.
Do you feel like, just briefly, we're just about out of time, do you feel like there is enough of a fan base here in Wisconsin?
I would like to think so, and I think that maybe there is because practically every public school in the state now has a jazz band. And if the students that go through those programs, you had two callers from Nina, they have a really good program there at Nina High School, for example. If the students who go through those programs can just be encouraged to get off your devices, get off your machines, and go out and hear live music, there's nothing like it.
Kurt, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thanks again for having me.
That was Kurt Dietrich, professor of music at Ripon College. He was with us to talk about his book, Wisconsin Riffs, Jazz Profiles from the Heartland. Join WPR tonight for live election coverage. NPR reports on national races starting at 7, and when polls close in Wisconsin at 8, Sean Johnson, Frederica Freiberg, and I will anchor WPR's coverage of statewide elections, including the races for governor and U.S. Senate.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll find out how races across the country and here in Wisconsin turned out, and we'll ask for your thoughts on the results.
In 2016, pollsters got some of their predictions a little wrong. We'll find out how they did with the midterm predictions and results.
And with Veterans Day coming up, we'll hear from a survivor of the Japanese attack on the USS Indianapolis on July 30th, 1945.
That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.
Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show. Tomorrow after 8:30, host John Munson and his guests take a look at the race to replace Paul Ryan in Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District. They'll also take a look at the state of bipartisanship in the wake of such contentious midterm elections. That's tomorrow morning after 8:30, right here on the Ideas Network.
Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll find out about a government board's decision to investigate a handful of doctors, dentists, and nurses for their history of prescribing opioid painkillers. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. This is Central Time.